Co-Innovations Podcast for Monday, September 19th, 2005, coming to you from Palo Alto, California. Hello, and welcome to the Co-Innovations Podcast. I'm your host, Phil McKinney. Before we get started, please keep in mind that the opinions expressed in this podcast are mine and mine alone and do not necessarily reflect those of my past, current, or future employers. Well, I'm back from my trips to Amsterdam and Venice, Italy. Interestingly enough, in Venice, there was no broadband, but had an interesting experience there. I was with Telecom Italia in their what they call their Future Center. So if anybody happens to be traveling to Venice, look it up. It is open to the public. In fact, in a future podcast, I may describe more of the whole process there and how they use that as a way to kind of highlight kind of future trends in telecommunications. Very, very interesting. I've spent a total of 36 hours on the ground in Washington, D.C. before I got on the flight today to San Francisco. So I do apologize. This podcast is getting out later than normal, but hopefully you'll get it here late Monday, if not early, very early on Tuesday. Previously, I mentioned that I was going to Singapore next after my trip here to San Francisco. I've canceled that trip and will now be going to New Orleans starting a week from today. So what would that be, the 26th, I guess, to help bring up phone and broadband network infrastructures in New Orleans as part of the disaster relief effort. If any of you want to join in and hang out for a week with me and a bunch of other very creative individuals in New Orleans, drop me an email. We'll be there from the 26th on that Monday through the next Sunday after that. This is a volunteer effort. I'm working through the FCC and other organizations, including FEMA, and supporting a nonprofit organization that I'm involved in. So again, if you're interested, drop me an email. I'd love to have you in. It'd be a great way to hang out for a week and help out some needy people get their phone and internet infrastructures back up and running. Thank you for the feedback on the email and the comments that have been posted up on Podcast Alley. I really do appreciate that. Please send your comments and feedback to podcast@killerinnovations.com, or you can call the feedback line at 703-636-4460, or as always, you can Skype me at Phil_McKinney. In this week's podcast, topic one, we're going to talk about building on the innovations of others. In previous podcasts, we've talked about the difference between breakthrough innovations and incremental innovations. But one misconception that many people have with regards to breakthrough innovations is it does not always mean the true eureka or truly 100% original. Most, if not all, innovations are based on something that has existed. You see something, you're currently, using a piece of software, or your industry has done it a certain way, and you use that as kind of that catalyst to come up with, how do I improve it? How do I change it? What could I potentially take from another industry and apply it to what the problem is I'm trying to solve? So again, you find that most innovations are not really that truly unique eureka moment. It's really building upon the shoulders or building upon the innovations of others that really lead to some of the really great breakthroughs. I don't remember who said it, but a quote goes something like, quote, "There never has been an original idea." And I don't know if I quite believe that, but I think it's a good premise from the standpoint of it isn't always that, wake up in the middle of the night with that absolute brilliant brainstorm and everything is truly unique and not based on anything else. I just, at least in my career and my experience, I don't think I've ever really come up with something that is just totally new. It is always based on either experiences or knowledge or having seen something that is out there that maybe doesn't work right as well, but that that I think I can improve upon. And the innovation comes from how do you drive those kinds of improvements. Now, improvements aren't constrained to just being incremental. Improvements truly can be those killer innovations. So in today's podcast, what I'm going to go through is I'm going to share with you a very interesting timeline that I got sent. I'm not sure who sent it to me. I've had it in my files for quite some time. But it's really talking about, those of us, at least in my case, I'm an absolute book addict. In fact, the joke is I have to lock my wallet into the trunk of the car when I walk into a bookstore. Otherwise, I will spend way too much money. And I have more books than I'll ever read in a lifetime. But I just have just this real love for books and for reading. But when you really think about it, today's books and the whole process of bookstores and how books are marketing are obviously based on innovations and ideas that were generated or created from way before. So I got the hold of this timeline that really does talk about, what were all the innovations and ideas that really allowed for us to experience the books that that we have today. So, first off, we need to obviously find out, or at least appreciate the fact that someone actually did invent paper. I'm not quite sure who invented paper, but the person who's probably most credited for the creation of paper is a guy by the name of Cao Lun, who was part of the Chinese court around 105 AD. Albeit he may not have been the first, but he was the first one to get it down in writing and getting credit. As far as taking tree bark and hemp and rags and fishnet and squishing it all together and experimenting and really coming up with the whole concept of paper. You kind of wonder, how do you come up with the idea of taking all of these things and throwing it together and pressing it all down and coming up with something that was clearly an alternative to what at that time was really the clay tablets, which was the way of writing things down prior to that. On the heels of that, then, you had the invention of movable type, and everybody knows that that was Gutenberg around 1450. Interestingly enough, everybody credits Gutenberg for creating the movable type with regards to printing the Bible, which is true. But one of the little deep, dark secrets that a lot of people don't realize or never learned is that really the big money maker for movable type was not in the production of Bibles, but in the production of early pornography or dirty stories. And actually, one of the things that I've learned and a lot of people who look at predicting the future quickly find out is that, albeit you can have your own personal beliefs around pornography, but pornography itself is actually a good predictor of future trends. Pornography was the early moneymaker profit margins for the whole web services concepts. They were the first ones to do video broadcasting over the internet. So there's a whole variety of technologies that for some reason the pornography industry latches on to, and in many cases are the first ones to really create a business model and generate profit. So, invention of movable type, Gutenberg. And then you had to think about who actually thought about taking movable type, paper, and writing the first novels. And there's a whole series of people, depending on who you believe, but the general premise is that the first novels were really written as part of, in early Japan, a way to document the stories that were being told amongst people. One in particular is called the Tale of the Genji, and really it was written by a woman who was serving in the Empress court in Japan. The Empress wanted a variety of different stories. She was tired of hearing the same old stories. And so she, this one particular woman, Sekaibu, sat down and actually started writing stories or documenting them and then telling them. And they got collected up into the whole story of this tale called The Tales of the Genji. And actually, there's a fairly recent translation of these stories of the early novels. And then obviously you got the novels, but then the next natural invention is the author of or creating children's books. And that was done by Jan Amos Comenius. I'm assuming I'm pronouncing this correct. And basically it's the precursor for Father Goose. And again, it was taking upon paper, books, movable type, and using the books to create material to help children understand new words or pictures. In some cases, they actually used them to show a picture and teach the students Latin. And so really the whole concept of educational books was clearly right on the heels. And then for those of us who like to write out all of anything we're doing by hand, it's the inventor of the pencil. Now people don't really realize how much innovation really goes into or what went into in the creation of the pencil. And you kind of have to understand a little bit of the history here. The original pencils were made from natural graphite from Britain. Now, France in the late 1700s was cut off from that because they were at war with Britain. And because of that, then that was the catalyst. The challenge being that people wanted pencils. You couldn't get natural graphite from Britain because of war. So what is the alternative? And it's that challenge or that market desire and gap that was generated because you couldn't get it because of the war that became the catalyst for the creation of the pencil. And Conti is the guy, Frenchman, who actually sat down and figured out how to create basically a man-made concoction that became really the whole idea behind the pencil. Same time, okay, you have pencil, now you need what? An eraser. And Joseph Priestley created or actually played around with the whole concept of vulcanized rubber, which was new at the time, and figured out that it actually removed the pencil marks. And so he was the one who actually made that connection. So, again, here's another example of something that was totally being used for something else, in this case, vulcanized rubber, being discovered to be able to solve another problem, which was removing the pencil markings. Interestingly enough, the design work that was done to try to put the eraser on the top of the pencil, there was an attempt to try to patent that, but the patent office actually declined because it said you could not patent taking two obvious items and just simply putting them together was unpatentable. So the actual eraser on the top of the pencil, there was an attempt to try to secure a patent on it, but it was declared invalid because of literally this. The patent office says that you can't patent combining two things with no new use. And then we've got the famous Waterman pens. Lewis Waterman was the inventor of the fountain pen, and that obviously made the ability to take what used to be quills and ink wells and be able to put that into your pocket and carry that with you. The one thing that I wish probably that Waterman had invented also was detergent in order to get the ink stains out of your shirt pockets once they leaked. Next, an interesting invention is the inventors of the ballpoint pen. So George Biro, or Biro, depending on how you want to pronounce it, was challenged during the war in order to come up with a way for British fighter pilots to be able to carry pens in their pockets. Fountain pens don't work. For those of you of us who travel a lot on airplanes, certain pens don't react very well given the altitude of flight. So Biro was challenged by the British government to come up with a new way to create a pen. And basically, he took what he saw as ink, the thicker, faster drying ink that's used in the printing press, to figure out a way to put that into a pen such that you could write it, and as you literally, the ink came out on the paper, it was the quick drying, literally driven by the idea of what he saw in the printing press activities. Interesting, though, is that George actually licensed that technology, which became, quote, the Bic pen, to the British government. And the British government bought all of the rights to the George's invention, and then used it with the Royal Air Force fighter pilots so they'd have something to write with. Again, the challenge of war, so that they wouldn't have to be using the fighter pilots, or I mean, be using the fountain pens and causing all of the leakages. Next came the first libraries. Peter Harrison is the architect of America's first library. It was built back in the mid-1700s, and then pretty much became universal everywhere in the U.S. and in the world, from the standpoint of collecting modern books, not just historicals, and the whole concept of reading. And then right on the heels of that is the invention of the bookmobile. And the first bookmobile rolled out in the early 1900s, actually in Maryland, just north of Washington, D.C. In fact, it was kind of funny. It was a black kind of a van wagon, and when it pulled up in front of people's houses, particularly the farms, it was mistaken as being the hearse, and people actually hesitated going out to the wagon to look at books. But it was a way to get the books out of the libraries and into the hands of the people who lived out in the rural areas and the agricultural farms, etc., and make books available to them. Noah Webster, publisher of the first dictionary, of the first American dictionary, and the collection of English words, key invention from the standpoint of agreeing on what the definition of certain words to ensure that they are properly used. Next is the inventor of the literary tour. Someone writes a book and they go off on tour speaking about their book, either in bookstores or now on TV shows, radio programs. Charles Dickens is actually the inventor of the literary tour. Prior to that, people would just publish their books, and people would just either buy it or not buy the book. In the case of Dickens, he turned it into a real money maker. In fact, he used to sell or give tickets away for his appearances. And in some cases, those tickets sold on the black market for the equivalent of $300 today. And so therefore, Dickens quickly figured out that he could make almost just as much money on tour as he did actually writing the book. And it generated a lot of press and a lot of interest in his books, and people quickly figured out that getting out there and doing a little bit of marketing was a great way to sell those books. First bestseller, the first author to have a book that sold more than 1 million copies was Harry Beecher Stowe. And in Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is a famous book that she wrote, was actually the first book to go to 1 million copies. In this case, it actually was such a big winner that it actually had to go through multiple printings, and is even still in print today. Next come all the prizes. There's a lot of book awards, book prizes that get awarded to authors. Winner of the first Nobel Prize for Literature, Sully Prudhomme. The whole issue of having book awards, recognition for authors, You would hope that authors would write good material and not focus on the awards. But reality is that egos do get involved, and the awards provide a recognition that a lot of people just continue to search for. And keep in mind that in the early days of book publishing, books were primarily hardback books. With the invention of new kinds of printing and binding technologies, then became the paperbacks. And paperbacks really allowed you to deliver a much lower cost item, and therefore open up the marketplace to a whole new set of readers. So Sir Alan Lane is the inventor of the paperback book. And then you've got the audiobooks. Now, many people think that the audiobook is a relatively new invention, but in reality, the first audiobook was produced in 1952 by Dylan Thomas. And again, it was a test to see if people would prefer to hear the hear a book versus reading it. And in fact, in the early cases of the audiobooks, it was primarily children's books in order to allow children to listen to them. Next came the typewriter. So up to that point, it was all done by hand, and then you had to have a typeset, with movable type in order to produce the book. Christopher Latham Sholes is the inventor of the typewriter, which allowed for authors to literally sit down and be able to produce a lot more material in a much shorter amount of time. Here's a trivia question for you. Who is the inventor of carbon paper? Now, for some of you on this podcast, you may not even know what carbon paper is. But in order to produce multiple copies, you would literally put carbon paper between multiple sheets of paper, stick it into your typewriter, type away, and the keys would literally hit the paper, hit the carbon paper, and transfer that same image onto the multiple pages, multiple copies underneath, which was critical for authors so that they could type out, produce three, four, five copies of a book, and therefore then be able to send those books around to publishers and have the publishers do the review. The inventor of carbon paper, Ralph Wedgwood, and it was invented in 1806. Next, which I think is probably one of the greatest inventions in modern time, is the inventing of the copy machine or the Xerox machine. Chester Carlson, who if we all should be intimately familiar with, being the inventor of the Xerox process, which alleviated the need of carbon paper. You could type out your book, stick it into a copy machine, and make as many copies as you want in order to send those around. On top of all of that, one invention that I also think is kind of an interesting invention area is the word processor. Michael Schreyer is the inventor of the word processor. It was invented in 1975 on his Altair, which was actually the first machine that Bill Gates and Paul Allen wrote BASIC for. And it was a program called Electric Pencil. Now, I actually remember using this piece of software, which is a scary thought. And basically, it simulated the typing activities that you would see in a typewriter in electronic form. 1979, Micropro bought Electric Pencil, and it got translated into a product called WordStar, which was actually the one of the very first big popular word processing programs. So when you think back from an innovation perspective, and you're holding that book and you're reading that novel or that business book this afternoon or this evening, think back to all of the inventions that happened prior to that in order to make that book possible. Paper, the invention of movable type, the authors who thought up of whether that be fiction or nonfiction, the invention of a pencil, the invention of an eraser, invention of pens, the invention of the dictionary so that you can, everyone can agree on the definition of a given word, the invention of a literary tour so that you'd even know that the book even existed, the marketing plans that generate to best-selling books such that authors can make a viable living off of writing books that we can then consume. Audiobooks, paperbacks, the invention of word processing. You could even argue the invention of the computer or the invention of laser printers. But the point here is not the specifics of each one of those inventions. The point here is that breakthrough or killer innovations are not dependent on really the whole concept that's got to be truly new or truly innovative. Breakthrough ideas generally come from building upon the work of others that happened before you. So with that in mind, one area to look at is to look in the industry that you're at. Know the history of the industry that you're involved in or the industry that you want to go into. Understand what has been the ideas and innovations that have occurred before. Then look at parallel industries. Look at industries that are maybe similar in structure or look at completely different industries. And then the exercise, what I do is I randomly pick inventions or ideas from these different industries and mash them together. And then think about, does that make sense? Is there an idea there? And use it as a catalyst for the brainstorming activities. So again, you know, as the quote that I shared before, there never has been an original idea. Breakthrough killer innovations come from building on the innovations of others. In segment two, I want to talk about an emerging trend that we're seeing, or at least that I'm seeing, particularly in emerging markets. Emerging markets being the high growth markets in the developing portions of the world. Think about the statistics that 2/3 of the world's population makes $1,500 US equivalent per year or less. So 2/3 of the world's population makes $1,500 per year or less as their annual income. Yet why do we in the developing portions of the world attempt to sell the same items that were originally designed for customers who easily make 30 times more in North America, Europe, and Japan? So you think about who are the heavy producers of items that are consumed around the world. So it's North America, Europe, and Japan. And we have this kind of biased opinion of simply picking up what it is we produce for those countries and think that they can be consumed the same everywhere in the world. Now, there's a great book called Profit at the Bottom of the Pyramid. And actually, I'm reading the book. I don't have it with me right here in the hotel room. But it's a great book talking about that there's great, great market opportunities. When you think about the pyramid as far as being total population by income bracket. So at the very top of the pyramid, it's those countries that have maybe smaller populations, but the average income is very, very high. And the bottom of the pyramid is large populations, but low average income. And there's a huge amount of profit that can be derived out of finding the unique problems in those emerging markets. Well, one emerging trend that I'm seeing that's coming up is what I would call microselling. And microselling is really based on taking what we do sell or what we do produce in the developed portions of the world and look at ways at repackaging, remanufacturing, and delivering those into the emerging markets in such a way that they can be effectively consumed. Some examples. Procter & Gamble has done a phenomenal job at repackaging soap and detergent. So take the soap and detergent And rather than trying to sell it in this big box or plastic and last for 2 months, and instead package it literally in single dose supplies and sell it for literally pennies. In this case, Procter & Gamble did this, and Unilever has done this in India and has turned it into being a huge, huge, huge seller. Same product, same formulation, packaged differently, and therefore can be priced differently if that meets the needs of that given market. Whirlpool. We think about washers and dryers as being kind of a developed country invention. But Whirlpool has figured out how to take these and really shrink them down to get a really, really low-cost appliance that can be purchased in these emerging markets. So taking the same thing that they produce and really aiming that at these target markets. Now, the challenge for a Whirlpool or Procter & Gamble is that they have to recognize, and we all have to recognize, that selling into these markets means that you probably are going to have a much smaller margin. But you're talking about a total market size opportunity that is orders of magnitude larger than what you have access to anywhere else in the world, such as China, Russia, Brazil, or India. So the willingness to think a little bit differently about the problem, which is willing to repackage, take a lower margin, and therefore then be able to drive a much higher volume of sales. Moving on to segment three, and we're running a little bit late, so I'm going to speed this up here a little bit. The killer question of the week. Given all the effort and time that I've been spending on providing or working with nonprofits in the relief effort in New Orleans and Gulfport, Mississippi, and given what I'm seeing from reports that are coming from the area on the relief efforts that we have underway, I think I picked out this week's killer question specifically around the hurricane disaster relief effort. I've learned more about disaster relief organizations, government organizations, international organizations providing relief effort. And I think the whole process is ripe for innovation. And so I'm going to propose, or I'm going to walk through here with the killer question of the week, but I also want to give out another homework assignment. Given what we're seeing in the disaster area, I'm going to ask for your ideas on how do we address the answer to this killer question. The killer question is, do existing solutions never solve the whole problem, even if combined? Do existing solutions never solve the whole problem, even if combined? And another way to flip that question is what gaps exist in the solution, even if combined? So even if you combine all the different component pieces of a solution, what gaps still exist in solving the problem? So for instance, what would it take to fill the gap in the disaster relief? We've all seen the news, we've seen the problems, everybody probably has an opinion. But what would it take to fill the gap in the disaster relief? What would it take to fill the gap in the overall experience of buying a car or making travel arrangements or using a mobile phone? So when you think about the overall product or solution you're delivering, everything has a gap. In the overall experience that your customer gets, or the overall experience that somebody is experiencing dealing with a disaster in New Orleans, there's always a gap. And what would it take to fill the gap? So again, this week's killer question is, do existing solutions never solve the whole problem, even if combined? And again, a slight twist on that is what gaps exist in the solution, even if all the solution components are combined? With that, we're going to wrap up. Apologize for this going a little bit long, and I apologize for a little bit of the rambling here. It's late And my clock is a little out of whack given coming from Italy to DC and then quickly hopping here to San Francisco and have a pretty hectic schedule here. But again, thanks for listening. Please keep the feedback coming. I'm looking for ideas for future podcasts, questions that you think should be answered, or just general feedback. You can send them an email form to podcast@killerinnovations.com. You can call the feedback line, 703-636-4460. And if you leave it on the feedback line, I'll play them at the end of the podcast. Or as always, you can Skype me at Phil_McKinney. Thanks for the votes over at Podcast Alley. Really do appreciate that. If you haven't voted, go over to podcastalley.com and cast your vote for your favorite podcast. Well, I'm really tongue-tied today. You can tell I'm tired, right? And also, if you wish to join me in New Orleans a week from today, drop me an email. I can send you the logistics information. The requirement being is that we look for people who can commit at least 5 to 6 days in New Orleans. The volunteer effort is everything from serving food to helping people begin the reconstruction on their homes. And in between those activities, we're going to be attempting to bring up some satellite downlink stations and actually deploy some mini temporary cell sites in order to bring mobile services up in New Orleans. So if you want to hang out, join me in New Orleans. Drop me an email and I'll send you the logistics information. Again, apologize for kind of the craziness on this podcast and a little bit of the rambling, but thanks for listening. Get subscribed, get others to subscribe, and we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.